Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne?
That old part of the ridge that went for the motorway was a beautiful residential area. It was sunny all day and it was just a little bit of paradise in Wellington. And to think that was going to go for a motorway, which it did, was just, you know, one of the big urban tragedies. The city councilman who was in charge of what was going to be this development of the ridge, what was left after they put the motorway through, he showed us a coloured drawing of what they envisaged. All the houses that were on it had been cleared off completely, and sticking up like sore thumbs on this ridge were about half a dozen tall blocks of flats. That's what they planned to do. To think that all of that was going to be swept away to put up these great blocks of flats was too appalling for words.
But in the dark struggle cold, I think about a garden bough, gentle as the leaves unfold, sitting up along the bay, distant and so far away. There's no peace for me.
First impression was that it was a very settled, old suburb. It had a community spirit. I think it had been fostered by the, you know, heightened, if you like, sharpened up by the motorway having been drilled right through its heart. You could never imagine a developer starting with a big ball and hammer in the middle of Sloane Square and thinking of changing the facade of Mayfair or any of those sort of areas.
Thorndon is Wellington's jewel, its oldest historic suburb, its residential heart. But in the 1960s, Thorndon was regarded by the city fathers as a slum, an eyesore, which could efficiently be bulldozed and replaced with modern high-rise flats, with a new motorway running through its heart. Watching the bulldozers ploughing through the historic Bolton Street Cemetery to create the motorway, those who loved the old suburb felt increasingly angry.
Can you believe this place? Well, can you? They're making money out of money. They're making buildings out of glass.
Well, when the motorway was first proposed, we of course were very concerned, because the proposal was to wipe out, you know, a large swath right through. The residents weren't the only ones concerned. There were several groups, including the retailers, who spent a lot of money financing an alternate scheme. The idea was not to destroy the houses, but to have a road that tucked into Tinakori Hill, with a tunnel underneath Anderson Park back onto the terrace and so on. Minimum destruction of houses. But it would have cost a little more because the tunnelling was expensive and it was cheaper to pull down houses. You destroy the shopping centre, you destroy the school, you wipe out half the population of an area, because that is cheaper than some alternative.
Man gets angry. What can
about the council meeting where they decided that the motorway would go through?
Well, we all went down. There was previously there'd been a group against the destruction of the cemetery, and so there were quite a group that didn't belong to Thorndon, and we had great support from some councillors like Roland O'Regan and Leonie Harkness and George Porter. And George Porter, who was an architect and had been very strong in architectural work, he, we thought, was our strongest ally. And when it came to the time of the vote, he voted for the motorway. And we were so also shocked, and we just couldn't believe it when it came to that particular moment. Helmut Einhorn is the one that I remember most. He was absolutely, really jumping up and down. We were all, first of all, in a state of shock and then anger, you know, because here was somebody who was our main ally and who understood the position, who should have remained firm, but he belonged to the citizens group who were favouring the motorway, and he then had to vote with the party.
The motorway was to cut Thorndon in half, and it was planned that one of the ramps onto the motorway would slice into Glenburvie Terrace. Residents there were told to expect demolitions.
The way the Ministry of Works seemed to operate was that they would, in an area, they would find a weak link, either an absentee owner who wanted to sell, offer them a good price, and immediately knock down the house, even though that area may not be wanted for actual motorway construction for some time in the future. And in the case of Glenburvie Terrace, the houses were demolished, and then, of course, a long time later, they decided that they didn't need the land after all. But, of course, the houses were gone. The Ministry of Works modus operandi was very, very ruthless, without any concern whatsoever for the people involved.
Did they give people the feeling that they had no choice in the matter?
Oh, I think that was the current atmosphere, that people were told you can't hold back progress, you might as well sell while we're offering you a reasonable price. And I think faced with a sort of inevitability, people caved in.
This is really not my home. Where are you, my lovely Jenny? I'm afraid and I'm alone. There's no peace for me.
Glenburvie Terrace was a microcosm of Thorndon society of the late 1950s. There were probably less than 20 houses in this narrow street. It was shaped like a horseshoe. There were no footpaths. Some houses were built below the road level because the road had been built up over many years. The coal carts used to come up with the horses. It was a servants' entrance for properties in Parliament Street. When I moved in there into a very dingy and ill-kept rooming house, it was full of single elderly people in their 70s and 80s who had come out usually from the UK or Ireland and had no family here. These were to be their last homes, and it was really terrible that although the Tenants Protection Act was still in force and they were protected by it, they were scared of bureaucracy, of a domineering landlord, of a faceless society, or of a faceless government steamroller, and they just left without taking any advice whatsoever and were scattered around the city. And in fact, many didn't live very long after that because the shock of moving from an environment where they'd lived for maybe 10, 15 years was just too much for them. They did like the suburb of Thorndon because it catered for people well. There were heaps of grocer shops and dairies and bootmakers and things like that. They didn't have to go far to enjoy their life and to live properly.
Tell us about a couple of those people who were in those rooming houses.
Well, one was a Miss Jenny Harper, who was like a little bird. She'd come from somewhere in England, and she was very mysterious, but she had been a tourist around the world. She must have come from private income sort of background, and she was as feisty as they could be. And she didn't like Mr. Hollyhock, as she called him, and didn't like our landlord. She took the furniture with her, and she said, "I'm not paying that robber, Baron." And then she just disappeared into a council flat. But the stress did tell on her, but she was a bright, chirpy little personality who was as fit as a fiddle until this sort of thing happened. The other one was a Miss Bowditch, who, again, had come from private means. I think she'd been a teacher of music, and she'd cycled around the world, which at the turn of the century would have been quite an achievement. And she came out here, and had retired and had started to lose his sight and was fragile psychologically. And I think the effect of her for having to go to a place where she had to learn how to move around a room again without banging into things, that must have been quite a shock for her. And I kept in touch with her for years, and she was very depressed by the whole situation because she believed that there would have been justice. She felt she hadn't been looked after properly.
And these are not the friends I know. These are not their smiling faces. A desert that no one should know. There's no peace for me.
Now, you stayed in these houses when a lot of people fled.
I was living in one of the houses, and being a very stroppy young woman and working for the department that was actually making sure we were all evicted, the Ministry of Works, I knew that under the Protected Tenancy Act, residents who lived there before a certain date could actually stay there until someone found you equivalent accommodation at a similar rental as a replacement. But I decided that I wasn't going, and I persuaded one or two others in our house to do the same, elderly people. And the landlord was very upset because he couldn't get his money, but eventually he served me an eviction notice, which I completely ignored. And eventually the Ministry of Works housed me in a wee rat-infested cottage across from the one I was occupying, and the other lady moved to a pensioner flat where she, the shock of having to go actually did turn her slightly senile. And the other lady went to another rooming house, but the two of us, the three of us did actually form a small in-house resistance group, as well as my being on the anti-motorway committee, along with others in the area.
What was it like those days when they were bulldozing all around you? I mean, can you still hear that sort of sound that was there all the time?
My house would vibrate constantly, and every now and then furniture and crockery would crash, and I would run off to the Ministry of Works and ask for £10 to replace my ornaments. And
did they cough up?
Oh, yes, yes. Anything to stop me from going to the press again.
Three people, architect Martin Hill, lawyer Shirley Smith, and TV researcher Gillian McGregor, decided to form the Thorndon Trust and buy one and then several of the old houses that were threatened by the proposed construction of the motorway ramp. Shirley did the conveyancing and raising the money, and then, with the help of the Thorndon Society, a group of concerned residents, they lobbied for the creation of an historically protected E-zone, a group of some 105 workers' cottages dating back between 1850s and the 1880s. They stood between Bowen Street, Tinnacori Road, and the motorway.
Our best moment was getting the E-zone, and we had a lot of opposition from Angus Construction for one lot they wanted to develop. We had two sessions before the judge, you know, quite lengthy, not just one day, and a lot of people put in their oar, and all the developers were fighting us as hard as they possibly could. And I was, of course, deeply embroiled in this and terribly keen to win. And we did eventually.
Was that a historic first? Was that the first historically protected zone in New Zealand?
It had never been done before.
That success with the E-zone raised hopes that eventually the city might give protection to all of Thorndon's old buildings. As early as 1968, Martin Hill had realised that Thorndon was a complete lexicon of Wellington-style early buildings, both grand and humble, and could possibly become a unique lived-in museum of buildings. He saw something others couldn't see.
Well, they still don't see. I mean, the essence is that colonial buildings are really of no great interest to people generally, unless money has been spent on them. I suppose my interest in it, it has been what exciting stuff can be inside. I mean, what we found in St Mary Street, where we found clothes that had fitted for several years, girls and boys, and they'd been extended and they'd been added to, and they're all hand sewn and so on. We found all the toys that they played with, and the wide range of toys, what Dad made for them, the trinkets that were broken by Mum and were then handed down to the child, and so on, all those exciting things. But then what the child collected and what the child thought important and stored in little places.
What sort of things did you find that the children had stored and collected?
Coloured things, yeah. I mean, brightly coloured glass and that sort of thing. But what children put on the walls.
Yes.
I mean, what Dad put on the walls, what Mum put on the walls. There's one little cottage which had the hall and no more than 900 wide, you know, 3 foot wide entrance hall. And there were, I suppose, about 8 or 9 ranges of wallpapers on that hall, and they ranged from all manner of imitations of stone walls round to imitations of timber walls. Yeah. And they must have alternated them all through the years, and they must have put them on every new wallpaper every 5 years or 3 years or something. It was quite extraordinary. Some of the cotton and fabric that was used to cover the joins in the boards before they put wallpaper on. We found some lovely hand-printed petticoat, and torn into strips. It obviously had something been wrong with it, but in fact the history of people's lives, what they did, is in the houses.
Mm. Yes. You must get very cross at people who say, look, there's no European history here in New Zealand. We're so unlucky. Unlike the Maoris, we haven't got any history of our own, because it's in those houses, isn't it?
Well, we're blind to it.
This was the living room. That was a table and some chairs. That could have been a pile of magazines. That is the door.
To save a suburb like Thorndon, it takes not only vision and the outspoken anger of residents, it takes strategy and doggedness. Two people blessed with those last two qualities were Mervyn Pope and Tony Burton, both of whom served as chairman and as town planning officers of the Thorndon Society at various times. Both were often referred to by frustrated developers as Thorndon's Mafia.
Mervyn was sort of a bear-like looking fellow. You'd never call him stout, but he looked like the sort of fellow you'd like on your side. Interesting, because he was in Muldoon's think tank, I think, at that time too. He was an economist by trade. In a very short time, I got to talking to him about what it was that the Thorndon Society was attempting to do. I mean, you could read the aims and objects were pretty simple. There are only two aims. The aim was to protect the residential building stock of Thorndon and the residential use of that stock, if you're going to paraphrase it. He was the guy who had sort of an overview of, you know, where it was going. So I became sort of like one of his followers, I suppose.
Now, just tell us a little bit about, because you say you've spent 25 years really fighting for this DSV 14, or the idea that's behind this DSV 14. It has just come through.
23.
What is it that, I mean, that's an awful long time. What is it that motivates you to do that?
I think it's a character quirk. Nothing more than that. I suppose I am a sort of a dogged person.
Because it's both you and Mervyn Pope have, in your time, been very unpopular among some people, especially among some developers.
Oh, that's never bothered. I don't think that. The lack of popularity never bothered Mervyn, and it certainly doesn't bother me. I don't think that would neither encourage nor discourage me. Mm. I think that you either know that you're doing the right thing or you're not. I don't think you walk around with doubts and think, oh, am I? I don't have a shilly-shallyness to me at all. If I think it is right, I will go for it until I can't go any further. Mm. This is New Zealand's remarkable collection of wooden colonial buildings that centre around 1870 as a almost a complete set. It also has that added part that the buildings have a great deal with New Zealand's founding history. This is where the two major churches centred themselves, and you have the centre of government, and indeed the New Zealand Company founded its offices here. The great business houses of New Zealand similarly have their starting buildings here, whether it's the Nathans or the Levins. They started their existence here.
Are you saying that you can actually see the whole society?
Oh, I think so.
You can see,
yes,
all the little servants' cottages alongside that, yes, served these big houses.
Indeed,
as well.
The pre-colonial period, Maridom has also settled itself, and it is really just the centre. And to think of that those buildings, the history of which is still being researched, in many cases we're not quite certain really of what their social history of some of those buildings are, to put those at risk would be from the city's point of view criminal, from New Zealand's point of view criminal. It would be a wastage. You get that idea that if you go to Europe, you could never imagine a developer starting with a big ball and hammer in the middle of Sloane Square and thinking of changing the facade of Mayfair or any of those sort of areas. That you just take it as a given. Well, that will be preserved. And you sort of wonder, when did they decide to do that? The day they built it? At some point, there was a decision made that, by Jove, this is about right. We ought to hold on to this. It's a sensible use of the area as the preservation of it.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne?
District Plan Variation Number 14. What a mouthful. But that dry-sounding phrase means that now none of Thorndon's older buildings can be knocked down as of right. It's this underlying connection with the past that gives Thorndon its liveliness and its sense of permanence. It's a suburb for people, not cars, a walking suburb. Today, just as in the 1860s, you can still wander down little lanes past cottage gardens. On a summer's evening, you can stroll through the botanic gardens, picnic, and listen to your favourite band playing in the park. In this case, Wellington's Warriters.
I don't want to drive down the street tonight.
You'll join us for episode 2 of Thorndon's Mafia. In that, the people of Thorndon will tell you just how they won their quarter-century battle to protect all the old buildings of Thorndon.
For auld lang syne, dear, for auld lang syne, we'll tak a cup o' kindness yet. For days of old lang syne.
In this first episode of Thorndon's Mafia, you've heard the voices of Shirley Smith, Tony Burton, Martin Hill, Max Wilkinson, Aileen Finucan, and Robin Archibald. Dougie MacLean sang Old Lang Syne, De Dunnan played Garden Valley, The Front Lawn sang and played Walk Around the House and Andy, and the Warriters played Down Your Street. Thorndon Mafia was recorded and produced for National Radio by me, Dinah Priestley, with technical assistance from Gareth Watkins, Jason McClelland, and Kelly Buckland.